this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Percy Schneider, who is a Canadian, and, of course, some of our friends over in Great Britain asked us and suggested we get him on the program because he'd have a lawsuit with Monsanto. Now, of course, you're not going to hear about this in the United States in our controlled media, but, of course, Monsanto is one of the most dangerous corporations in the world today, turning out genetically modified food that is doing damage to people and animals. And, of course, if you read any of the studies on this, we have a four-tape set on genetically modified food, which everybody should listen to and understand that the scientific studies show that, at least in the animal studies, this is harm to the animals, and yet people, it does harm to the people and alters certain blood components, but this is not even being considered. In other countries in the world, they will not allow genetically modified food in. Here, they're doing a massive experiment on the American people, but will have deadly consequences. But Mr. Schneider won a lawsuit with Monsanto. I'm going to let him tell the story, because certainly he's been on the front lines of this battle. He's been all over Europe talking, and not hardly a word about it here in the American press. Mr. Schneider, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on this evening.
Why don't you go ahead and give us the background of what this was really all about, and, of course, when you take on a corporation, a multi-billion-dollar corporation, that takes a lot of courage.
Well, we never realized at the beginning in 1998 when Monsanto laid the lawsuit. It was called a patent infringement lawsuit against my wife and myself, where they accused us of growing their GMO or genetic modified organisms, canola, without a license from them. So that was the beginning, 1998.
Now, tell us what happened. Basically, you had planted your field, and what happened? Was there pollen that came from the other fields and contaminated your field?
Well, what happened was that it was introduced here in 1996, and 2 years later, as I said, they laid a lawsuit, and they said that I was growing their GMO canola license. We had never bought their seed. We didn't even know anybody bought from Monsanto. And so we were very concerned about this because we were seed developers, my wife and I, in canola for 50 years. And we realized that all our research and development, especially now the results of that research and development, was now contaminated with Monsanto's GMOs without without us even knowing about it. So it was a big concern, and we stood up to them. And just briefly, it went to a federal court of Canada, because most patent laws in most countries of the world come under federal jurisdiction. And in the 2 years of pre-trial, before it went to the main trial, we had one judge, but no jury. Federal court, you have no jury. And how often we wish we could have had a jury with farmers on, and who knew and understood farming, but that was not to be. And in the 2 years of pre-trial, Monsanto admitted that we had never bought their seed, but they said it didn't matter if they had contaminated us. They own our seeds and plants now, and all our research and development through patent law. So this is what the trial judge ruled, and I'll just give some of the rulings. He said, first of all, it does not matter how a farmer is contaminated. And he went down to specify how this could happen: cross-pollination, with pollen flowing, through the air, or by birds, bees, animals, whatever, or by seeds blown in the wind or transportation by farmers. And if that happens to an organic farmer, conventional farmer like myself, you no longer own your seeds or plants to become Monsanto's ownership through patent law. So that was pretty devastating. And then he ruled that we were not allowed to use our seeds or plants again because of the contamination. Rate of contamination does not matter. If it's 1% or 5%, you no longer own your seeds or plants.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Sure.
All right, well, so what happened now? Chris, this was a judge, and Chris, basically, what he was saying is that it doesn't matter that they contaminated your seeds. They now own your seeds because they've contaminated your seeds. Was there any farmers in the area that actually had planted that Monsanto, and was there actually a pollination from adjacent fields? What really happened?
Really, what happened in 1998, we were able to get to a conclusion that it had blown in from my neighbor, and Monsanto had never told us that our neighbor was growing Monsanto's GMO canola license. So seeds had fallen off a truck or blown in the wind, and that's where the contamination came from. And after we had spent a lot of time to figure out where the contamination came from, the judge ruled it doesn't matter where it came from. If you are contaminated, it's their property. So that was another real blow to us. And then we appealed it to the Federal Court of Appeal in Canada, and then we had three judges, and the three judges ruled that basically they upheld the trial judge's decision, but didn't agree on all the points. And at that point in time, it should have been thrown out, but it was not. So we have spent around $300,000 already in legal bills, 4 to 5 years of time. And then we had one avenue left, and that was the Supreme Court of Canada. And we were successful that in our application, and the Supreme Court heard it. But at the Supreme Court, we could bring in other items than just a patent infringement charge that Monsanto laid against us. And by this time, Monsanto wanted over $1 million for us in punitive damage, license fees, many other areas, their legal fees and so on. So, but at the Supreme Court, we could bring in that a farmer should always have the right to use his seeds from year to year, that also a consumer should have the right to know what they are eating. We should have labeling. And then one final thing that was really important to my wife and myself was that no one, no company, no individual should have the right to put patents on life or any higher life form, whether it's a seed, plant, bird, bee, animal, or human being. So those are the items that went to the Supreme Court, and the ruling of the Supreme Court was this briefly, is that we didn't have to pay Monsanto any money whatsoever. But what was not fair was that the Supreme Court ruled we pay our legal bill, Monsanto pays their legal bill, and you have to remember they laid the lawsuit against us, and they lost because they didn't get no money whatsoever. And it's a lot easier for a $1 billion corporation to pay their $2 million legal fees versus a farmer standing up for his rights and the rights of private farmers to pay $400,000.
All right, you hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, what happened was, of course, that they went to the first judge, and the first judge found in Monsanto's favor. They went to an appeals court, and, of course, the appeals court found 2-1 against Percy, and certainly went right along with Monsanto. But eventually, and of course, by this time, Monsanto is demanding $1 million of payment from Percy. Why? Because they had contaminated his fields. That's quite logical. And, of course, then they wanted him to pay all of their legal fees. And, of course, they have, this is a $1 billion company. You're probably talking about $1 million or two in legal fees. And Percy's having to put out the money on his own. Well, eventually the case goes then to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found in Percy's favor that Monsanto lost the case. But of course, no charges were leveled against Monsanto for Percy's field, or Percy's legal fees, which ran about $400,000. And how many years were you involved in this, Percy?
7 years.
7 years. So certainly Monsanto, they could absorb, you know, their legal fees of a couple of $1 million. But you have to understand, when you're going up against a $1 billion company, they don't care. They want to crush people. And they wanted to crush anybody who stood in their way. Of course, what they want to do is control all seeds. And I mean, the issue was they've contaminated Percy's seeds. Now, have you ever been able to get your seeds uncontaminated again?
No. It's once you introduce a new life form, like a new into the environment, we don't know at this time if you ever can recall it back. But the unusual part, on the other part of the judgment of the Supreme Court, they said that Monsanto's patent on a gene is valid, and wherever that gene arrives in any higher life form, they own and control that life form. So now you have more questions than you have answers, because how far do you go with the patents on life forms? Do you go bird, bee, animal, seed, plant, ultimately in the human being? And I think Monsanto thought they had a major victory when the Supreme Court, they own and control that life form, but now it's coming home to haunt them, because if you own and control a life form, you put it in an environment where you now know, and everyone knows, you can't control seeds blowing in the wind or cross-pollination, then there's a liability issue now, and they should be held liable for the damages. And this is exactly what has happened to Monsanto now, because in 2005, we did notice some of Monsanto's GMO plants, canola plants in our field. We notified Monsanto. They refused. They came and checked it and certified that it indeed was their GMO canola. And they asked us what we wanted done, and we said we wanted all the canola plants pulled by hand on a 50-acre piece, and they agreed to do this. But 2 days later, they sent a fax to my wife and said, before they do this, we have to sign a release document. Now, just listen to what they wanted in this release document. First of all, we could not talk to anyone, a gag order, what the terms of settlement were. I couldn't talk to you. I couldn't talk to my neighbors. That was bad enough, my freedom of speech being taken away. But worst of all, my wife, no, or any member of my family or myself, could never, ever take Monsanto to court for the rest of our lives, irregardless how much they contaminated us in the future on this field. And we said, no way to Monsanto. We will never give up our freedom of speech to a corporation. And so Monsanto refused to remove the plants. We then removed the plants and then sent Monsanto the bill. We had a couple of neighbors helping us, a bill for $640, $20 cost, and then we took Monsanto then to small claims court, and we had Monsanto in court on a $640 bill.
And did you win?
You bet your life. March 19th, they went to court. Monsanto, at the beginning of the trial, settled out of court, paid the fee, and it was a total of $660, and also no gag order, and we could sue Monsanto again tomorrow if they contaminate us. Now, it wasn't the issue of the $660. The whole issue now is sets a precedent. Monsanto agreed to pay for the contamination and the cleanup costs. So now farmers all over the world have an avenue or a way of now of taking Monsanto to court, or Bayer or Syngenta or any other corporation, when they contaminate you. And they know once you introduce a GMO, they will contaminate people. A farmer now knows that if he grows GMOs, he will contaminate his neighbor. So it's no longer what can happen or may happen, but now what will happen if you grow GMOs. So I think it was a major victory for, after 10 years of legal battle with Monsanto, to win this, not only for ourselves, but for the rights of farmers all over the world.
Well, now tell me, what do we know about the canola genetically modified seeds? What do we know about the effect of that oil on human beings? What are the scientific studies, what scientific studies does Monsanto have that show that it's perfectly safe, it's just like regular canola, only now it's genetically modified?
Even Monsanto, in their tests they did privately, had to be released to various governments around the world. And even their own tests now, which has been revealed, showed the harmful effects on the environment, the harmful effects of on human beings, the massive increased use of chemicals. Because if you introduce GMOs, you'll use 3 to 5 times more chemicals, because new superweeds develop with the introduction of GMOs. And it doesn't matter if it's GMO corn or maize, BT cotton or GMO cotton or soybeans, or canola, the 4 principal crops that were introduced in 1996, so yields go down. And I said massive use of chemicals, less nutritious, but there's a lot of effect on human health, and basically some of this is this. First of all, when you transfer a gene from one life form to another to make a plant resistant to Monsanto's chemical herbicide Roundup, you can never move that gene by itself. You have to use a virus or a bacteria, or in a case of canola, an antibiotic-resistant marker gene. So besides eating a GMO gene in your food, you're also eating a new virus or a bacteria or an antibiotic resistant marker gene that was never in your food before.
Now, this is the antibiotic resistant gene. In other words, it actually is resistant to antibiotics, so if you needed the antibiotic, it wouldn't work.
Exactly, and that's what's happened to many, many of our farm population here where you grow a lot of canola. And I'm in the heart of canola growing area in Canada, and there's many, many farm people now who have various ailments where antibiotics have no effect whatsoever because the bodies now, human bodies have become totally immune to antibiotics because of the resistant marker gene. You breathe it in the pollen flow. And now, at the present time, our canola is blooming, the beautiful yellow all over our country here. But you can imagine what farmers, children, and wives of farmers are breathing in now. And it's been proven here now that certain ailments, treatment by antibiotics have no effect.
And, of course, is anybody concerned about that? Is anybody thinking of suing, Monsanto for destroying the immunity and the antibiotic, response of the people, the farmers, the children? I mean, certainly this is a criminal act, and they haven't told people about this. They've kept this under wraps for a long time.
For a long time, and they were supposed to get. The government had said to these companies, change the vector, as they call it, or the carrying agent of that gene from one form to another, life form to another, and they were supposed to have it out by 2008, which is this year. They couldn't find another vector or promoter to transfer this gene, and now I think they have an extension of 2015. Well, thanks a lot, to our government to allow this.
Well, now, what about the people, or what about the person who is, of course, using canola oil, and they use canola oil in a lot of things? What happens to them as they ingest this canola oil? Do they end up with this antibiotic-resistant virus?
Well, the gene is in every cell of a plant.
Right.
And so what has happened, and I hate to say this, is that a lot of people here, although we grow canola, don't use canola oil anymore. And that's very sad because we can't sell our canola to many countries of the world, and we've lost our major markets because people don't want GMO canola, don't want GMO corn or soybeans.
Well, I think it's really so interesting, of course, that if they're experimenting on the American, the Canadian people, the people of Europe don't want these genetically altered products. But we're not even allowed to tell the American people that when they're buying genetically altered products. Isn't that right?
That's correct. I spent a lot of time in Europe, and I just came back 3 weeks ago. And then also I had a very interesting, I was invited by the Duma, or the Parliament of Russia, to speak. And they've done a lot of research on the effects of GMO food, especially potatoes. And here you have Russia more advanced in research than our research here in Canada and the United States.
But there
it's open. They're allowed to express and tell the people. And it's not allowed there. GMOs are not allowed.
And, of course, the difficulty is that the media is controlled in the United States. Information like this of how we are harming the people of our countries, Canada and America, because we're certainly joined together. We have many, many things in common. And they're simply experimenting on our people. The Monsanto has bought off high government officials and high political officials, and they are going to eventually destroy the lives of an awful lot of people here. We don't know the long-term results of what we're doing. And, of course, in Europe, they're aware of it. They will not allow these products in. And here in the United States, why, you're not even allowed to know. In fact, when people want to market a product and say this is not genetically modified, they're not allowed to by the Federal Drug Administration. For instance, that's true with the milk you're getting that the cow has been treated with this recombinant bovine growth hormone to increase. And you can't find out that you're getting milk that doesn't have this in it. And most of your milk is produced this manner. And there are changes. In fact, you get into the incidence of breast carcinoma and prostate cancer carcinoma associated with the use of this milk, and it's dramatically increased. And they know that. They just don't let the American people know that. Have you got into that at all, Percy?
Oh, many times. I really kind of feel hurt when I'm in Europe, and I'm in Europe a lot. I was back here for 3 months. in the fall, when they say, in Europe, we don't even have to do any testing in Europe because
hold that thought. All right, go right ahead. You're saying in Europe they say they don't have to do testing because they don't want to be the guinea pig?
No, they just use that as a saying. They said they don't have to do testing because the whole North America are guinea pigs that are being, you know, that's their test. But Europe has labeling, and many other countries of the world, and people want to know what's in their food. And I think it's a real drastic violation of human rights in both our countries here. When we don't know what's in our food, our government doesn't want to give labeling. The corporations are fighting in tooth and nail because they know the minute you have labeling, then if you have a problem with your health, doctors can form or develop a database. And we cannot do it this way when we don't know what's in our food. And so it's a drastic violation of consumer rights, human rights. We have a drastic violation of our academic community because a lot of our research, our universities and so on, are now funded by the corporations and not by the public purse. And this has got to stop. And I often think about it in my own case. I've got 6 grandkids in university right now. What will their future be when they're total muzzled with their research work?
Well, of course, this has been going on for a long time, and then, of course, we have the people at the FDA, everybody. You know, of course, if they are good, if they go right along with the corporations, when they retire, they can go to work for the corporations at a fabulous salary, and, of course, this is how the system really works. And they're simply being bribed, but, of course, the American people aren't being told, and of course, this information is not getting out through the controlled media. Well, now, who has been actually sponsoring your journeys over to Europe? Are the people there encouraging you to come and arranging for you to speak, in various groups?
Yeah, it can be like many different organizations, governments, European Commission, European Parliament, Russia, it was the Duma, the Parliament there, they invited me, NGO groups, organic farmers a lot, and even I get invited to many universities like around the world. Even I've been invited by Harvard, Berkeley 3-4 times, Cornell. I'm going to Yale in September. So whether it's a college of law, environment, health, there's a lot of interest because there's so many concerns now and there's so many areas of GMOs. And like I mentioned, the health issue, the environmental issue, the biodiversity, the patent law, and the control of farmers that they can't use their own seed. And so human rights issue. So I get invited to speak on all these different topics around the world.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's so vitally important that you get the message out because there are not many people talking about the dangers of GMOs, genetically modified foods, but there is no question that the studies show that they are dangerous, and as you said, the people of Europe realize that they're using us as guinea pigs. Why, the American people say that couldn't happen here. We've got the government to protect us. No, ladies and gentlemen, in my estimation, the government is on the side of the people who want to use you as a guinea pig. After all, there are too many people in the world, and they're going to have to die of something, aren't they?
You mentioned something that has really bothered me. We have the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, which comes under the Federal Department of Agriculture. And Monsanto would always say, it's safe. It's been approved by the Canadian government. But here's an interesting point. The Canadian government has never, ever did one bit of testing on the safety of GMO foods. They only have used the data supplied to them, by Monsanto.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Percy. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Percy was simply saying that they have something comparable to our FDA in Canada, and the Canadian group has never once tested any of these things. All they've done is take Monsanto's word, of course, for their test and to tell them it's perfectly normal, this is just normal food. We've just even modified it. They try to make you think it's just like, you know, like people do when they would tend to modify corn seeds, but they're not. They're actually introducing genes and viruses and all these things. Things, use them as carriers, and of course some of these, the things that they used to carry these genes into the genetic makeup of the products are dangerous in themselves. So, and the same thing is really true in the United States. The FDA is just simply using Monsanto's information, and if you look at it, and certainly our friend Jeffrey Smith has looked at that and simply pointed out how absolutely dangerous this material is. And of course, what even Monsanto's studies, when you can finally see the whole thing, and of course they lie about what it shows, but if you go over it and you find out, of course, there are damage done to the human beings by this, but they keep saying, well, it's really of no consequence. What about long-term use? Well, of course, we're guinea pigs, ladies and gentlemen. You, your children, your family are guinea pigs, and the average individual has no idea what's going on, or the total disregard by people highly placed in government for the health of the American people. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, if you have a question or comment on this, because Percy is on the front lines of this battle. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Percy, what's happened as far as your farming is concerned? Are you able to produce seeds there? Because if you produce seeds, they're going to be contaminated with Monsanto's material. Are you still growing canola? What are you doing?
No, like I'm a retirement age, I'm 77 years of age, but I still have the farm rented out. I still farm one quarter section, 160 acres, to maintain my farming status. But I cannot grow conventional canola no more, because there is no pure canola seed left in Canada here now.
There is no pure canola seed left in Canada?
No pure seed left. It is all contaminated. There is no pure soybean seed left. It is all contaminated. So you cannot raise an organic canola, or you cannot raise organic soybeans of the contamination. So it takes choice away. Once you introduce it into any particular variety of seeds or plants, it's over, and it all becomes GMO.
Now, what about corn? Is the same thing happening as far as corn?
Eventually, your total corn supply will also be contaminated.
I think that's so interesting. We know, for instance, they're taking the seeds and they're storing them someplace in, I believe, in Norway, above the Arctic Circle. Why? Because I think there are people who know that they're going to destroy all the seeds here in the world, and then, of course, when this is all over, they can start afresh. Why else would they be storing those seeds at tremendous expense? And, of course, the people really know what they're doing. They're contaminating the corn crop, the canola crop, the cottonseed crop, and what's the fourth one?
See, cotton, gosh, soybeans, canola.
Soybeans, right.
That's the fourth.
And of course, then they're contaminating all the soybean crops as well, and here in the United States as well as in your country?
Exactly. You see, here's another very important point that a lot of people don't realize. And that's really has been happening here with our canola. Canola comes from the brassica family, and in that family have very close cousins like radishes, turnips, cauliflower, and even mustard. And then wild, distant cousins like wild mustard. Through cross-pollination, the GMOs are now going into those market garden crops, making more crops GMOs or organic farmers no longer can raise. So it does not only affect the plant you put it into, it affects every member of that plant family that plant comes from. So that is very alarming, and that's happening here already.
I see. Of course, now, as far as Europe is concerned, they're not allowing either the growth or the importation of these products, are they?
No. No, they're very concerned, and, you know, there's moratoriums. Like right now, there's a 10-year moratorium in Poland, 5-year one in Switzerland, in Ireland, and other countries of the world, where they said they have to use the precautionary principle, which was never ever used here. And you know, it's sad. My wife and I were seed developers for 50 years. We no longer can raise canola because the land is contaminated. We cannot buy pure seed. So choice is taken away. And I remember what Monsanto said, would used to say, you have a choice. If a farmer doesn't want to grow GMOs, he doesn't have to.
Well, is there any way that they can sue Monsanto for everything they have for contaminating the crops, all of our crops?
Well, you know, there's a big liability issue, and I believe if there's one way these companies can be brought down is that now, like with the case that I just won. There's a liability issue. They know they will contaminate if they introduce...
Hold the call. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, the reason you're not hearing this sort of thing in most radio stations, television stations, is because when people start to talk about this, Monsanto comes in and says, we're going to sue you. We got billions of dollars. We'll destroy you. Maybe you'll win the case, but you'll end up destroyed. And they've actually threatened. There's one instance where a couple who actually, they were husband and wife team that did television programs for one of the major networks. They wanted to tell the story about, certainly about milk, and I believe they were going to be going into the background of the recombinant bovine growth hormone there and the relationship of the milk that was produced to cancer. And the networks all set to actually put the program on until Monsanto got wind of it. They called for network was notified, told that they would be sued, and they were to fire the people. And they fired this husband and wife, and they can't get a job any other place in television. You can go up and look up the story on the internet; it's there. And this is what really happens. Monsanto was powerful enough not only to force the networks to bury these stories, but to fire the people who want to bring out the truth, and then to blacklist them so they can't get jobs in their chosen profession. Could this really be going on in America? Have you heard these stories, Percy?
Oh, I'm fully aware of them, and I know of hundreds of farmers have been totally destroyed. You know, the Center for Food Safety in Washington has documented at least 100 cases where the average settlement was $150,000 by these farmers. One was over $2 million, which totally destroys farmers. And we've had our share of stress. You can imagine the living hell we went through. One time, one of Monsanto's rep shook his fist in my wife's face and my face and said, nobody stands up to Monsanto. We're going to get you, and we're going to destroy you somehow someday. They tried to seize all our farmland with liens and caveats against it. They tried to seize our home, our farm equipment. They tried to destroy us totally because, we had to fight them. There was not only the one lawsuit, there was two other lawsuits against us to try and protect our property. So, like I said, I wish it done to no one. And they would go after our neighbors and said, if you support Percy and Louis Schmeiser, we're going to come after you and do to you the same as we're doing to them. So you can imagine the, and then the extortion letters, you know, letters that they send out to farmers, it's unbelievable. I'm not talking about a third world country. I'm talking about our countries. And I'll give you an example of what we call an extortion letter. If they can't find a farmer at home to harass or intimidate, they'll send him a letter and says, we have ended the letter briefly.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Percy's been talking about, of course, how he has been threatened, how they put their fist in his wife's face and said, we're going to destroy you, we're going to crush you, nobody can stand up to Monsanto. How they've intimidated his neighbors and told him they would destroy them, how they brought other lawsuits, tried to take away his home, tried to take away his land, used every legal trick at all to crush anybody who dared to try to stand against Monsanto. And, of course, you were just about to tell me another story.
Okay, the other story is that they'll send what we call extortion letters, and in that letter it'll say to a farmer, we have reason to believe you might be grown Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola without a license. We estimate you have 300 acres, 400 acres, and in lieu of us not taking you to court, send us $200,000, $100,000, $500,000 in 2 weeks' time, and we may or may not take you to court because we think you might be growing it. Can you imagine the fear in a farm family when they get one of these extortion letters from a billion-dollar corporation, send us that kind of money, because they think you might be growing it. And in the letter also, there's a paragraph states, you're not allowed to show this letter to anyone, or we will fine you and destroy you.
We'll fine you and destroy you. That's what they're saying?
Yeah.
Well, Chris, has this ever been taken to court? Have anybody else gone after Monsanto? Because, of course, if enough people did, if enough people brought suits, you could break them. If there were 1,000 farmers who would bring suits against them, think of their legal expenses.
Well, that's what it'll take. But remember that Monsanto has a budget of $10 million a year with 70 lawyers on staff to do nothing but to intimidate, harass, and take farmers to court. And that's an actual figure.
Well, our telephone number here is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And ladies and gentlemen, this corporation threatens people. They threaten his wife. They threaten his family. So basically, do you have a webpage, Persia, that where people get more information?
I sure do. You know, it's www.persiashmiser, and that's spelled P-E-R-C-Y-S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R.
Spell that once more. Percy.
Percy, P-E-R-C-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And Schmeiser, S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R.com.
Schmeiser, okay, fine. All right, fine. So we've misspelled it, but we'll get that corrected. That's Schmeiser, S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R. Is that right?
Right.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Michael, who's calling from Fort Worth, Texas. And if you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Michael, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, I just am amazed at how wonderful and brave and unselfish that Percy and his family are to stand up to this. It's just they're sure to be congratulated, and everybody owes them thanks. For what I'm wondering is what kind of lawyers did you have, and did you just have a local lawyer, or did you have somebody that had part of the cause to?
Well, first of all, I had to get a lawyer firm that was that specialized in patent law because it was a patent infringement case.
Sure.
But by the time it went to the Supreme Court, I had even a couple of lawyers from the United States that came to the Supreme Court of Canada and helped my lawyer. And these lawyers that came from U.S. and Eastern Canada didn't charge. I only had to pay my one lawyer, but still, you know, my whole total legal bill still was over $400,000.
Oh, I'm sure it was, everybody should be thankful, and of course that's the problem with the whole system is these just professional bullies and of course Monsanto's not the only one. The insurance companies are acting that same way. The people are just told that we're going to break you and destroy you or do what we want to do. It's a fascist it's just a terrible thing, but you're sure to be congratulated, and Dr. Stan, you're to be congratulated and complimented for putting Percy on. I've heard him before when his case was getting started, and I'm really happy and congratulate him on being successful. Although it cost him a lot of money, I'm sure, to be successful, that's a terrible thing, too.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, and thank God bless. Bye-bye. Let's go to Billy calling from Caldwell, Idaho. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And hi, Billy, how are you doing?
Pretty good. I just started listening to your show a month ago. I really like it. Wanted to talk about milk cows.
Right.
Okay, where did you call that one stuff? The whole
it's called as recombinant bovine growth hormone, that they want to give it to milk cows so that they can actually increase milk production.
Okay, I haul milk, and I bring up a big dairy that has over 6,000 head of cattle, and cows, milk cows, and the place I take it to here in Oregon, they will not take milk that has that in it. And I have to put a sticker on the bill of lading that says RBST free.
All right, Father, I'm glad that at least some people are aware of this. Most people don't even know that or the relationship between cancer, breast cancer, I mean, going up, what, 6 times, prostate cancer going up 3 times. This is being totally suppressed by those people in government who are there to protect our health, or maybe protect us from good health, something like that.
My boss told me for a fact it's documented that the cows, when they shoot them with that hormone, are only good for 3 years of milking, and then they got to sell them for slaughter.
Sure.
I go to some dairies when I just call local, and it's just the cows that they do inject that into have their bags are so big, it's just you can tell they're uncomfortable. I mean, you know, they have to walk squat, and you can tell it's ruining them.
Okay, so.
And I'm just wondering what we're drinking.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, you certainly don't want to be drinking that milk. Anyway, I really appreciate you calling, Billy. Anything else you want to say? Thank you. And do you have any thoughts on what he was saying there?
Well, yes, I'm fully aware of the bovine growth of my own, and you know, I've had many calls and talked to farmers that had used it, and their cows are burnt out within 2 years, you know, the United States is the only country in the world that is using it.
Right, of course we're just being experimented on. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand that they got a real problem with Medicare, Social Security, and they're just too many older people. But don't you worry, they have a problem. They have a solution for the problem. They just don't want you to know that you are the problem. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Hi, Jack, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, Dr. Stan. I first wanted to congratulate Percy for his perseverance and courage in pursuing this. If I'm not mistaken, I believe I saw Percy in a presentation by the Bioneers on Free Speech TV 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, Monsanto had accused Percy of stealing their intellectual property, even though he was downwind and their genetically modified canola pollen had contaminated his organic farmland.
That's exactly what happened, Jack. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. So I got to thinking, Dr. Stan, if the USDA can threaten a fella, and this is the other part of my question for Percy, if they can threaten this organic cattle fella who is going to do the, I think, the ELISA test on his cattle because the Japanese government told him, do the ELISA test, prove that there's no mad cow according to our test, and then we'll buy at a premium price all your organic beef.
But, of course, they won't allow him to test the cows for mad cow disease. I think that they know that there's mad cow disease out there, and the last thing they want is for the American people to know that. They're refusing, absolutely refusing, to allow cattle growers to test their cows. Mm-hmm. Why would you do that? Doesn't make any sense unless there's something they don't want the American people to know.
And I was thinking, Dr. Stan, why couldn't people like Percy patent some aspect of the organic operation relative to it being contaminated by a Monsanto-type operation?
Well, this is what he can't patent what they have done. They have the patent on it, but the thing is that they are responsible for contaminating literally all of the canola and all of the soybeans and all of the corn and all of the cotton, which is used for cottonseed oil here in the Northern Hemisphere. And Americans are going to die in large numbers because of this, and nobody's going to have any idea why it happened. Oh, shucks, we have no idea why almost one in two or one in three people are getting cancer today, whereas, of course, you know, 100 years ago it was one in 33. We have no idea what is happening, but we can assure you that it has nothing to do with, of course, what you're eating. And do you have any comment at all on what Zach is saying, Percy?
Well, we're really aware here of the high increased rates of prostate cancer, breast cancer, especially in the farming area. You have to remember, in our province here of Saskatchewan, we use one-third of all the chemicals in Canada, but we're really paying a price for it in the high rates of prostate cancer and breast cancer. And the whole thing being totally hidden, from us, by all the media and the papers in the house, because it's controlled by the corporations.
And I'm curious, I think it was really such an interesting point that you raised, that when you use this Roundup Ready canola, well, you're going to have to use a lot more of these toxic chemicals and pesticides. And what people don't understand is the relationship between Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease and these chemicals. And they have a toxic effect on the brain, and of course a toxic effect on every aspect of this body. They also predispose to cancer, and you say they have a much higher rate of breast and prostate cancer in your province?
Exactly. That was the highest rates in Canada. And you have to remember that once you introduce GMOs, the companies were telling the farmers back in 96, you less chemical use. But now, if you have GMOs, I'll guarantee you, you'll use 3 to 5 times more chemicals, more highly, more toxic and more powerful chemicals than ever before, because of the new super weeds that have developed with the introduction of GMOs.
And of course, isn't there also a factor that that they actually, what's the relationship between Monsanto and Roundup? Do they produce Roundup, or do they have a contract with the people who do?
No, Monsanto, a flagship in profit making, is their herbicide Roundup.
In other words, basically what they've done is they've created a herbicide, and then they've got a crop that will not respond to the herbicide, but now we get the super weeds in there, because that really thing makes things even worse. You've got to use a lot more of the pesticide, and that's
exactly
the, and of course every time, every cell in that in the canola plant or in the corn plant or in the certainly in the cotton or the soybean, every cell there is contaminated with these viruses and other genes that they're using. Jack, you have anything else to say before we let you go?
Thank you, Dr. Stein. Yes, why you brought this up, I got to thinking. Is there any requirement in Canada or U.S. Requiring labeling of genetically modified foodstuffs?
No, there's no requirement. We want labeling. People of the U.S. and Canada, we had a survey in Canada a number of years ago. 91% of the Canadian people said we would not eat GMOs if we knew what was in their food or if we had labeling. So there you are, but that's why it would stop the GMO companies tomorrow if we had labeling.
Okay. Well, I understand every chance I get locally, I'm attempting to organize a grassroots think tank based upon your program. So this is more ammunition for me right here.
All right, God bless you. Thanks so much, Jack. It's good to hear from you.
Thank you. God bless
bye-bye.
You.
You too. Bye-bye. And Chris, that was Jack from Michigan. If you have a question, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Percy, did you ever think you maybe had been better off just to have given them $100,000 and have them go away and leave you alone?
No, I couldn't live with myself. I was, you know, I've been in agriculture. I was also a member of the provincial parliament. I was on agricultural committees both provincially and federally, and I always worked for farmers' rights, rules, laws, and regulations. And I couldn't live with myself. I wouldn't have stood up. I know the stress I put on my wife, on my family, and my friends. But there's a couple of very important points we have not touched on, and I'd like to maybe touch on briefly. It's the Terminator gene and also the Primal Plants.
All right, go ahead for you. Please tell us.
Okay, GMOs were really meant for the control, complete control of the seed supply and food supply, and that's what it's all about. And it had nothing to do with increased yields. Now, the Terminator gene, Monsanto owns 50% of it now, and the U.S. government owns the other 50%. And it's a gene that's put into a seed, and when the seed becomes a plant, all the seeds from that plant are sterile and cannot be used again. And the danger of that Terminator gene is that it can cross-pollinate into indigenous crops, organic crops, and render all those seeds also sterile. The Terminator gene can be installed into any higher life form, which basically, when I use that term, I mean basically a seed. And so that, to me, that's the greatest assault on life we've ever seen on the space of this planet. When they want to bring in a seed that, or a plant that bears that seed, is sterile, and you cannot use it, That would force a person, a gardener, a tree planter, a farmer, back to buy their seed each year. And that's what it's all about. But to come out, these companies call themselves life science. It's anything but life science. It's death science. And that's what they want, to get control of the world seed supply. Forces a farmer to buy the seed each year because his seeds produced from that plant are sterile.
All right, fine. I think it's really rather frightening because, of course, if they control the seeds, they can control the food supply. They control the food supply. They control the population. Okay,
now,
and then what was the other item you wanted to mention?
Okay, with the palmer plant, there's about six major drugs now being produced by plants. And this is not done in an enclosed facility. It's done in the open or in the wild, as we call it. And the, and these six major drugs, I'll just, if I can just from memory, tell you quickly, it's industrial enzymes, growth hormones, contraceptives, blood thinners, blood clotters. So you can imagine, it's not only what we're eating GMOs with viruses and bacteria. We could be eating foods now with a pharmaceutical drug in.
And they could contaminate other products just from the pollination.
Exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about is something of a truly Frankenseeds, I think it's the term that somebody's used for that. People say these things couldn't be going on if they were going on. Why, Rush Limbaugh would be telling us, as Sean Hannity, Brian Williams, they'd be telling us. But would they? Have they? Ladies and gentlemen, everybody's within the reach of our voice is in potential danger from what's going on. And, well, we need to get the word out. It's up to you. Well, Percy, we've got one more call. Oh, we lost our caller from Texas. Anyway, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Okay. But, you know, I'm not talking about some science fiction. It's what's going on. And that's one of the reasons when you asked me. I knew a lot about this. I had some very good teachers in genetics, teachers of it. And I really, you know, the more I studied and the more I learned, the more concerned I became. And, you know, what kind of a legacy, you know, my wife and I, we have had kids, 15 grandchildren and one great-grandchild, and we looked at it this way. What kind of a legacy do we want to leave to future generations? Because what we decide now will affect them because there is no calling back. You can have an oil spill. You can have a chemical spill. Eventually you can clean it up. But a chemical drift? No. Yeah, or a genetic drift, there is no calling back as we know today. And that's why it's so important, the decisions we make for the future generations.
And I think it's absolutely correct. And I think it's so vitally important that people understand the implications of what's going on. And of course, there obviously are people who really understand. They know, of course, that eventually they're going to have to go back and start from nothing. And that's why they're storing the seeds up, you know, in Norway above the Arctic Circle in underground caverns there, you know, in ice caverns. So that, of course, when this all comes down and there's mass destruction, then, of course, they will start in all over again. People say that could be going on. This could not be what it was behind this. Why do you think they're storing those seeds up there? I'm sure you've looked into this as well, haven't you, Percy?
Oh, very much so. And the same comments that you're making, there's a reason. These corporations know that they're destroying the seed supply and contaminating it. And they know that then by having these seeds in these massive seed banks, that they would have then total control of the world seed supply.
Well, let's get your website out one more time so people will know how to get in touch with you.
It's www.percyschmeiser.com, and Percy, P-E-R-C-Y, Schmeiser, S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R, and that's all one word, .com. And on that, you also see I have a trust fund set up which will help me pay my legal bills. But that's on that website.
All right, fine. Well, I appreciate, and I know our listeners appreciate your courage and your integrity in doing what is right. And I do hope some of our listeners out there will give serious consideration to helping you, doing what you're doing. And God bless you for what you've done. I hope we can call on you and perhaps get you onto some of our other radio programs. Will you be around for a while there in Canada?
Well, I'll be here now till the end of August, and then I'll be off and on in Canada in September, October, November. I'll be traveling a lot in Europe.
Hold that thought, Robert. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Percy Smyser, and it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so very much for being with us, Percy, and I will call you, and because I'd like all of our audiences to hear your story.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and my message now is to bring awareness.
God bless you. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, and God bless you.
Bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our program out there, ladies and gentlemen. I do want to comment that we do have a four-tape set on this subject. It's called Genetically Modified Foods. It's genetically modified foods, and we encourage you to get that. It's got so much of the information that we've been talking about. It's readily available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-888-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a copy of this program or some of our other programs, why, of course, they are available through Radio Liberty. But you need to get the information. You can get these on four-tape sets or on CDs. You need to have the information. You need to help us get it out because, believe me, the life you save could be your own. If you doubt that there really are people, totally wicked people who really do intend to kill off most of the population of the world, you really need to get the four tape set we have. It's called The New Order of the Barbarians. It's based upon interviews with a Dr. Dunnigan, who is a practicing pediatrician in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and three of the interviews are done by Randy Engel. I did one of the interviews myself. As he tells the story of having heard Dr. Richard Day, the former medical director of Planned Parenthood, lay out the whole story of their plan for the destruction of contemporary society, how they were going to create new and terrible diseases because there were too many people in the world, how they were going to actively suppress the treatments for cancer because people would die of something, they would have to die of cancer, and how they had treatments and they were suppressing those treatments. How many of you know somebody who's died of cancer, a slow, horrible, painful death? Would you believe that there have been treatments around for 50 years that have been actively suppressed? Well, of course, let me suggest you get this four-tape or four-CD set, The New Order of the Barbarians, and there is, of course, the transcript of this, if you get it. It costs a little bit more than the others because we've actually had to get the right to produce this from Randy Engel, who did the interviews, but they're vitally important for you to hear. And then, of course, what we hope is that you will, of course, want to get my material on Nandare College Genocide. It's a talk we have on DVD. Another talk we have is entitled The Planned Population Reduction. That planned population reduction, that you can get the overview of what is going on. We have the book A World Without Cancer. If you doubt that there is an effort to suppress the information, you go over on the Internet and look for the Fitzsimmons report. The Fitzgerald report is the title. And, of course, you won't find it any place except on our website. And this is Kim's out of the Congressional Record. It's been suppressed for better part of 50 years, telling about the treatments for cancer that were available 50 years ago. And that report, nobody had a copy of it until we were able to get track one down with the help, of course, of Dr. Dennis Cuddy, our good friend. Well, anyway, of course, and then, of course, we hope you'll want to go to our website and pull down our Population Control Agenda monograph, or you can get that directly from us. It's as good as anything to explain what motivates these people. If you want to understand how they're using water fluoridation, why you want to get our material, called The Hidden Agenda. It's a talk available on DVD, and of course there's a syllabus that goes with that, excellent syllabus. You want to know how they're poisoning us with mercury, you want to get the DVD by Dr. David Ayoub, Mercury, Autism, and the Global Population Agenda, and when you get that DVD, you get a free CD-ROM with literally thousands of pages of documentation on the toxicity of mercury that the government knows about. They're poisoning you with it. We also have several other DVDs on mercury. We have a four-tape set on mercury. We have the book Evidence of Harm on Mercury. If you want to know how they're poisoning you with aspartame, why, of course, we have four-tape sets on that and DVDs, Sweet Misery, Sweet Remedy. And, of course, the information is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. And then we ask you, of course, to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers. Don't forget that fourth tape set on genetically modified food. We'll be right back. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But the battle survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Brian Rosner as we talk about Lyme disease, which is certainly another one of the things that's plaguing our society. There's probably about 1 million people in America who have Lyme disease. Doctors who try to treat this get into real problems with the medical societies. There's an organized effort to block the effective treatment of this disease, to look into the background of it. And, of course, it involves much more than the spirochete, the Borrelia, the spirochete, but we're going to talk to Brian and get his information because he's actually had the disease, and he spent a lot of time studying the disease, and of course he's got himself back in fairly good shape. He's written a book, and we'll be talking about that book a little later this evening. Brian, thank you so very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Why don't you give us your background, how you got involved with this, what your experiences were, and what you found as you began to study it?
Sure. Well, I have a background in journalism, and I contracted Lyme disease back in 2002, and I wasn't aware that it was a disease of misinformation and misconception, so I followed all the basic steps that someone with Lyme disease might take, and I got absolutely nowhere and completely cleaned out my bank account. And that was when I started doing some research and you know, realizing that there's quite a bit of misconception about the disease, and, you know, there was hardly anything written on the topic.
All right, fine. Well, what did you discover? Because, of course, there are groups of doctors who try to work below the radar treating the patients. And, well, of course, there's so much misinformation out there as well as treatment. And we've got almost, what, 1 million people that have the disease?
Yeah, let me give you some background information. What you're talking about, there are two groups out there. One is called the IDSA, which stands for the Infectious Disease Society of America. And that group has insisted for decades that there's no such thing as chronic Lyme disease, but the storm is brewing, and we're actually sort of in the perfect storm right now. Another group called the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society has been challenging the IDSA for years, and they're finally making some large headway. There was a story on CNN just a few days ago about the chronic form of Lyme disease. Let me tell you a little bit about some of the misconceptions about Lyme disease. There are so many, it would take a whole hour just to talk about them, but let's talk about some of the important ones. First, most people believe that Lyme disease can only be transmitted by a tick bite. This is actually not the case. There are other insects, such as fleas and dust mites, that can also transmit the disease. There's a doctor in Florida named Dr. James Schaller. He's a good friend of mine. He has a new book on Lyme disease that presents a number of other ways that the bacteria can be transmitted. For the listeners that don't know what Lyme disease is, it is a bacterial infection. Another way that Lyme disease can be transmitted that most people are not aware of is sexual contact. Lyme disease is a cousin of syphilis, which we all know is a sexually transmitted disease. Both of them are spirochetes, so Lyme disease can be transmitted sexually as well. One of the least known methods of transmission of Lyme disease is from mother to child during pregnancy across the womb. I've actually just finished writing a book. It was published last week called The Lyme Autism Connection. And that book talks about the connection between Lyme disease and childhood developmental disorders. And some people say, well, how can that happen? How can a baby get Lyme disease? Well, it can be transferred from the mother during pregnancy to the baby. The second area of misconception that is really important is the diagnosis process. Most people think that you can just take a test, a simple blood test, and get diagnosed with Lyme disease. Well, that's not the case. About 40% of Lyme disease tests lead to false negative results, meaning that after somebody takes the test, the test shows negative even when somebody actually has the disease. And to complicate matters even worse, many physicians in this country do not check for Lyme disease, so the tests never even get ordered. But if they do get ordered, people still test negative, and they think that they don't have it, so they spend 10
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. right, Brian, you were just saying that many people have the take the test, and of course it's negative, and they think they don't have the disease, but of course they really do. It's because many of the tests are false negatives. Go ahead.
Yeah, they are false negatives, and this is a big problem because there are a number of diseases that can mimic Lyme disease, such as fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, even things like Alzheimer's disease, and so people never even know that they have it. Another important misconception that people on your station might be interested in is that there is Lyme disease in California. The Centers for Disease Control website itself reports that California is one of the top 20 states for Lyme disease in the country, which most people don't know, especially the coastal areas. The CDC has reported an exponential increase in Lyme disease, and some of the hot spots where that increase is taking place is in California. Now, if you're out on a trail hiking and you happen to get bit by a tick, please remember that you do not need to have the telltale bullseye rash to get Lyme disease. You know, most doctors on the East Coast associate the bullseye rash with the disease. Well, about 50% of people that get Lyme disease don't even remember the rash. And to make matters even more convoluted, the ticks that are most likely to pass on Lyme disease are called nymph ticks. They're the baby ticks. They're about the size of the head of a pin. They're transparent in color. You'd never even know if you got bit by one. So when you combine all these factors with the false negative test results, you have quite a lot of misinformation about Lyme disease, and we are really fighting an uphill battle right now to educate people not only about how prevalent the disease is, but about how hard it is to get properly diagnosed.
All right, fine. Well, then, how do you get properly diagnosed, Sydney, if the standard blood test is, leaves 40% of the people undiagnosed? Are there more sensitive blood tests that you can get?
Yes, there are. There are a number of laboratories out there now that are offering more sensitive tests. One of them is called the Bowen Lab. One of them is called Igenics. Both of these are discussed in my book. The title of my book is The Top 10 Lyme Disease Treatments. It's available at LymeBook.com, LymeBook.com. Another method that physicians commonly use to diagnose Lyme disease is what we call a therapeutic trial. And that is when we give a patient a trial course of Lyme disease treatment to see how they respond. Lyme disease is one of the few diseases that involves what's known as a Herxheimer reaction, and that is also commonly called die-off. And what that means is when you kill the bacteria, you feel worse before you get better. So if somebody suspects that they have Lyme disease and they have a negative test result and they want to make sure, they should find a physician who would be willing to do a therapeutic trial of antibiotics. And if they start to have die-off reactions, which is, the best way to explain that is feeling sick before you feel better, then that's a pretty good indication that a person might have Lyme disease.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Brian. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Brian Rosner, I should say, is our guest this evening. And Brian basically is saying that, of course, the blood test is certainly not valid. There are more sensitive blood tests that can be done. And, of course, if you have a negative test the first time around, you need to find a doctor who specializes in this. Now, there are organizations out there, and I'm sure he discusses them in his book, and you'll find them on the Internet. There are organizations of doctors who specialize in this, but believe me, they get in real trouble with, of course, the medical organizations and the state board, medical boards, for trying to treat this disease. My goodness, why would that be? Well, of course, the same thing holds true with chronic fatigue syndrome and chronic fibromyalgia and certain of the other terrible disabling diseases that I believe, of course, have been and I think the last thing they want is for the American people to know the truth. But be that as it may, we can argue the origins of the disease. Brian is saying, Sydney, not only you simply can get the blood test. If you still think you have Lyme disease, you can actually, again, if you can get a doctor who will give you a treatment for it, that would be long-term use of antibiotics. You'll get something called a Herxheimer reaction. A Herxheimer reaction comes as you begin to kill the spirochete. Certainly this is true with syphilis. It is true with Lyme disease, which is produced primarily by a spirochete. And, of course, the old idea that you get gets worse before you get better, and you react, of course, to the killing off of the spiral keys. So you go ahead and pick up the story there. What are the symptoms of the disease? What sort of problems will people have? And what would draw their attention to the fact that they have Lyme disease?
Sure, that's an important question. Just to back up for 1 second, when somebody looks for a doctor, it's very important that they realize that there is a heated debate currently taking place in the Lyme disease community and the government. And many doctors right now do not acknowledge the existence of chronic Lyme disease, and they don't acknowledge it in California. So before you just walk into your general practitioner's office, make sure you go to the trouble of getting a referral to what we call a Lyme-literate medical doctor. That's Lyme-literate medical doctor. For short, we say LLMD. And these are the doctors who have been trained and educated in Lyme disease. There are a number of LLMD organizations, although some of these doctors try to keep a pretty low profile because of the persecution that we were just talking about. In my book, you can find a referral to Lyme disease doctors, a source for that referral. But as you were mentioning, the symptoms of Lyme disease, that is another complicating factor. Lyme disease is a multi-systemic disorder. It starts out as an acute infection, and it gets into the bloodstream and causes fever, headache, nausea, some joint pain, and that type of thing. But very soon after, there's actually some new research that shows that Lyme disease can penetrate into the central nervous system as soon as 1 to 2 days, if you can believe that, after infection. The reason it can penetrate so quickly is that the spirochetes are little spiral bacteria that are almost like drill bits, and they can drill right through your tissue, right through the blood-brain barrier. So after that happens, the symptoms really start to take on a life of their own. Lots of neurological symptoms, memory loss, brain fog, we call it, when you sort of can't think straight, sleep loss, food allergies, and then from there it branches into, as I was mentioning before, all kinds of mental disorders, autism, Alzheimer's disease, even schizophrenia. And, you know, some people, that's one of the reasons that Lyme disease is so controversial, is people can't believe that one simple bacteria can cause such a slew of problems. We actually refer to Lyme disease as the great imitator because it can imitate almost any other disease. And, of course, we already know that about syphilis. Syphilis was called the great imitator, so Lyme disease now is called the new great imitator.
All right, fine. And, Chris, then you get mental symptoms, you get flu-like symptoms, you get arthritis. Arthritis is certainly one of the results of chronic Lyme disease, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Arthritis is one of the primary problems. The Lyme disease bacteria tends to proliferate in areas where blood flow is not as strong as it is throughout the body, and joints happen to be one place where it really can proliferate. So you do get a lot of joint pain and debilitation. But again, it's a common misconception that if someone does not have joint pain, that they don't have Lyme disease. That's just not true. Some people never have any joint pain, and they still do have Lyme disease. So it's very important for us to really spread the truth and get rid of the misinformation, so that somebody might be sitting there tonight listening to this with chronic fatigue syndrome, and they might have ruled Lyme disease out because they don't have joint pain and they didn't have a positive test, but in reality, they still may have it, and they should probably seek a Lyme-literate medical doctor.
And of course, the same thing would hold true for the chronic fatigue syndrome?
Yes. You know, chronic fatigue syndrome is such a, what we call a garbage bag diagnosis, meaning that it really can be caused by a lot of different things. It can be caused by hormonal imbalances, viral infections, even stress, adrenal fatigue. So by no means are we saying that Lyme disease is the cause of all cases of chronic fatigue syndrome. However, there is a cross-section of chronic fatigue patients who do in fact have Lyme disease and do in fact improve on antibiotic therapy. Something we probably should talk about, I'm not sure when you'd like to do that, is the failure rate of antibiotics. That's getting into a whole other part of our discussion here, is that probably about 70 to 80% of Lyme sufferers do recover on antibiotic therapy, but there's a high percentage, maybe 20 to 30%, which really amounts to hundreds of thousands or millions of people that do not get well on antibiotic treatment, and that opens up a whole new can of worms. How these people are going to seek treatment, how they're going to pay for treatment, is the insurance or insurance carrier is going to cover their treatment, and that sort of brings us into the whole realm of chronic Lyme disease. The people that do recover from acute Lyme disease are very lucky. They take 2 to 3 weeks of doxycycline, which is a tetracycline antibiotic, and they get well. But the chronic Lyme disease sufferers who don't get well, their number is increasing dramatically. I heard an estimate a couple of days ago. This estimate was actually on CNN, that that as many as 30% of families in the highest Lyme endemic states, such as New Jersey, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Delaware, have 30% of families have at least one family member that is currently suffering from chronic Lyme disease. I mean, that is a mind-blowing statistic. That is becoming a very mainstream problem.
Well, how about long-term, either oral or intravenous use of antibiotics in the treatment of Lyme disease? Is there a place for that?
Absolutely. That's the first recommendation that a Lyme-literate medical doctor will tell you to pursue is long-term antibiotic treatment, which usually involves a cephalosporin antibiotic such as rocephin or a macrolide like Zithromax. Many people do recover that way, but that does introduce a new set of problems. For example, Lyme disease bacteria is capable of defending itself and switching into what we call cell wall deficient or cyst form in the presence of antibiotics. What this form does is it basically becomes impenetrable to any sort of treatment, and it just sits there and hides out in your tissues and waits. And while you're taking high doses of antibiotics for months on end, these antibiotics are weakening your system and creating candida problems, which is yeast overgrowth in the gut. And then when you stop the antibiotics, perhaps 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, whatever down the road, the bacteria senses that the environment is again favorable and reconverts into the spirochete form and then starts to cause problems. So you start to have this picture that emerges of a very resistant disease, and that's why it's so controversial. A Yale-graduated PhD, brilliant researcher by the name of Lita Matman, was one of the first people to discover the cell wall deficient form. She actually has a textbook that I have in front of me here that's called, it's called just that, cell wall deficient forms, and she chronicles the conversion of these bacteria into a cell wall deficient form when they're exposed to antibiotics. The reason that the bacteria choose, well, they don't choose, but the reason that the evolutionary forces have caused them to undergo this conversion is the fact that most antibiotics attack either protein synthesis or cell wall development in bacteria. So when they do convert into this this form, they are no longer susceptible to antibiotics. So the next question then is if somebody has a long-term chronic case of Lyme disease and the long-term antibiotics are not doing the trick, then what do you do? And, boy, you really open up a can of worms there because there are lots of people trying to make money off of innocent sick people with quote-unquote alternative treatments that may or may not work. Some of them, in fact, work very well and have worked well for me. Other treatments, in my opinion, are just sort of a money-making scheme. One of the things that these types of chronic Lyme sufferers want to look for when they have what we call antibiotic-resistant or antibiotic-refractory Lyme disease is they want to look for treatments that are sustainable. To beat Lyme disease, you really have to use these treatments for quite a long time. And one of the requirements of a sustainable, well, actually I'll list a few of the requirements of sustainable Lyme disease treatment. It has to be affordable. It either has to be affordable or you have to get insurance coverage for it. It has to be relatively convenient. There's a treatment called hyperbaric oxygen chamber treatment in which a patient sits in a pressurized tank and gets oxygen driven deep into their tissues. Lyme bacteria doesn't like the oxygen. That's a great treatment. Problem is, I know of dozens of people who have done that treatment for 6 months. They have to spend all day at a clinic. They have to miss work. They spend their life savings on this expensive treatment, maybe $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, and then they relapse after the 6 months. So one of the requirements of the treatment that I talk about in my book, the top 10 Lyme disease treatments, that's the title of the book, one of the requirements is that these treatments have to be sustainable, they have to be affordable, they have to be convenient, they have to be, in my opinion, ideally treatments that one can do in the privacy of their own home without the travel expense and inconvenience of going to see a doctor for years on end. Now, I don't have any problem with going to see doctors, but if somebody has to do a treatment for 2 or 3 years, it's really going to ruin their life if they can't do it in a sustainable fashion.
And I think that's really a very, very real factor. And, of course, these are desperate people. You talk to the people who have these symptoms, and, of course, they go from doctor to doctor, conventional doctors, good doctors, but they really don't know, and I believe, of course, there's an organized effort to prevent the information, the truth about Lyme disease from coming out. We put together a 4-tape set on it, and probably down the line, while we'll be carrying a Brian's book. It sounds like a fascinating book. He's sending me a copy of it. You need to understand that this and other diseases are out there. They're chronic diseases. They're disabling diseases. I believe they're designed to disable the enemy. Of course, there's a great deal of question as to where Lyme disease came from, and maybe when we get back, we can ask that question. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Brian Rosner. You were just talking about the disease. I raised the question, where did this disease originate? Because this is a new disease. This was not around when I went to medical school. It really didn't appear until about 1980?
Yeah, in 1983, the disease was named after a city in Lyme, Connecticut. There's actually a city named Lyme, Connecticut, and that's where it got its name. The first people that noticed it were some doctors that noticed children in the city had knee problems that didn't go away. You bring up a very intriguing question, that is, where did Lyme disease come from? And, you know, this question is really almost as controversial as the other topics we've been talking about relating to diagnosis and treatment and those other subjects. And the reason that it's controversial is because anybody who does their homework on Lyme disease will know that there is evidence pointing to the fact that it is a much older disease than since 1983. Now, you might ask, well, why didn't you hear about it in medical school? Why wasn't it talked about in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and in that era? Well, the reason is because they hadn't identified it yet. It was what is known as an idiopathic disease, which means without known cause. It was sort of people got sick and they died, and that was just the way it went. Now, I'm not saying for sure that it's older than 1983, but there is evidence. There was a doctor in Europe who noticed bullseye rashes and documented something very similar to Lyme disease. And one of the current theories about the origin of Lyme disease is that it was a government bioweapon experiment gone wrong. There's actually a biomedical research facility on Plum Island that the government has used in the past for biomedical weaponry. So the first cases of Lyme disease did originate very close to Plum Island, and if you look at the spread of Lyme disease, it actually spreads out from that point in concentric circles. It almost seems very convincing that it did originate from that government facility. However, at the same time, I just published a book in January called The 2008 Lyme Disease Annual Report, and I spent a lot of time researching the international geographic incidence of Lyme disease across the world. And there is different strains of the Borrelia organism. That's what we call Lyme disease bacteria. The primary strain is Borrelia burgdorferi. There are different strains of Borrelia organisms found on every continent, from Greenland, Europe, Iceland, Russia, Africa, and it's all documented in peer-reviewed journals. That's available in my 2008 annual report. And so on the one hand, you see this evidence that shows that it did originate in this very centralized geographic area. But on the other hand, you have this overwhelming evidence that the geographic prevalence of Lyme disease across the world is really amazing. And so, you know, you sort of have these juxtaposed viewpoints about where it originated. You know, as a journalist, I sort of like the slogan of Fox News, you know, we report, you decide. So that's kind of the attitude that I take on this. I will report what I find. Honestly, anybody who says they know for sure, in my opinion, I'm sure somebody does know for sure, but in my opinion, I don't. I don't know anybody who does. It's somewhat of a mystery right now, but there is some interesting evidence to examine out there.
Well, of course, it may occur, this disease, but is it a pathological disease as it occurs in other countries? Do they have other epidemics of it, or is this simply a Borrelia that is not very pathogenic?
Well, no, it is very pathogenic in other countries, and this is, you know, I was telling you earlier that we're sort of in the perfect storm right now in Lyme disease media attention.
Well, that's all. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is, of course, Brian Rosner. We were asking where the disease came from, and of course, Brian mentions that some people think it was a genetically created disease created by the biowarfare people that got out of hand. And then, of course, he says, but on the other hand, it is present in many other countries throughout the world. How long has it been present in many other countries throughout the world? Is it a fairly new occurrence there as well?
Well, again, to answer that question, you really have to look at our diagnostic capabilities. In other words, when did these other countries start to have the capability of microscopically studying this bacteria in the laboratory? That is very recent. It's just over the last 20 years that we've been able to do that. However, to say that Lyme disease just sprung into existence all of a sudden when we got advanced microbiology laboratories is a bit of a logical fallacy. In other words, it probably existed before we found it, and then we just happened to find it 20 or 30 years ago. The research that I cite in my annual report is mostly over the last 40 years or so, so it is fairly recent. But it is amazing how many countries really are experiencing this problem right now. There's a group called EuroLyme, which is a European Lyme disease support group, and they email me all the time just with devastating stories about how the physicians over there are not recognizing this problem, and they're experiencing all of the same treatment issues we are now. Of course, in countries where medical freedom is a little bit more free than it is in the United States, they have less of a problem with the restrictions we have on Lyme disease doctors, but boy, it sure is a widespread problem.
All right, fine. Of course, there's some people who believe that there has been an effort to create certain chronic diseases. And, of course, we have the testimony of Dr. David MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee asking in 1969 for $10 million to create not only a disease, of course, for it to be no immune response, but a chronic disease with disabled people. And, of course, we have 2 years later, Zygmunt Brzezinski writing in his book, Between Two Ages, about how in the future we're going to be able to create these wonderful chronic diseases to disable the enemy. And, of course, Zygmunt Brzezinski, of course, is one of the key players in everything going on today. Today is the, what are we talking about 38 years later? He is the foreign policy advisor to a man named Barack Obama. So it's a small world. Well, anyway, of course, we're talking about the background. We don't know where the disease came from, but it's only recently been recognized. Brian suggests maybe it's been around a lot longer. We didn't recognize it there. During those times. Well, then, of course, what are they doing in other countries to treat the disease? Do they have any more effective treatments than we do?
Well, you know, that's really a fascinating question, actually. In 2003, I traveled to Italy myself, a very desperate Lyme disease patient, to undergo a treatment that is known as intracellular hyperthermia therapy. And what they do is they give you a chemical that is actually illegal in the United States. And it's actually a pesticide, and it increases your cellular temperature inside your cells up to about 104 degrees. If you go too high, it can actually kill you. In fact, a cancer patient in the room next to me died when I was there. I saw his body get rolled out of the room. It was quite traumatic. My sister was there with me, sort of supporting me. But there are a number of different approaches in different countries. Now, of course, because Lyme disease is a bacterial infection, the standard treatment, obviously is going to be antibiotics, but I'll give you one example of a treatment that is used in other countries. I have a book called Lyme Disease and Rife Machines, and a Rife machine is an electromagnetic frequency device that is very common in doctor's offices in Switzerland, Germany, and even in Canada now. It just became approved. And so the electromagnetic frequency device has been showing some promise in treating Lyme disease. It actually sort of electrocutes the bacteria. This treatment is viewed with a high degree of skepticism in the United States, so its benefits aren't really being utilized here. But in other countries, they are using it with quite a bit of success. In fact, the reason that I wrote that book on the Rife machine, I was one of the skeptical people, and to me it seemed like quackery to me, but I ended up working with a researcher in Seattle who had been trained in Switzerland, and he had just so much valuable information on the treatment. That particular treatment for me was one of the most helpful treatments. It was a electromagnetic frequency device, which, we talked about earlier in the show how ideal Lyme disease treatment is sustainable, meaning that you can do it at home, you can do it on a budget. It's non-toxic. I didn't mention that one earlier. That's very important that the sustainable treatment is non-toxic.
Well, okay, so did this treatment help you, the Rife treatment?
Yes, it did help me.
All right. I think people have to know that Raymond, a royal wife, of course, was here in America. He developed here in America. He even developed a very, very special type of a microscope, which is seized by the government. And, of course, his treatment is outlawed, or for all intents and purposes, outlawed here. They make it's very difficult to find anybody who uses it. Was that doctor up in Seattle named Tom something or other?
No, his name was actually Doug McLean, but interestingly...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, of course, is Brian Rosner, and you were just talking about the Rife machine and its treatment for Lyme disease, which is, of course, being used throughout the rest of the world, but not being allowed here in America to be used, although it is being used, but certainly end of the table with a great risk to the practitioner. So tell me about your experience using the Rife machine.
Sure. This is actually one of the areas that I'm most excited to talk about. This is my primary area of research, the Rife machine. As you mentioned, Dr. Rife was a scientist in the 1930s who discovered that microorganisms could be deactivated by exposing them to specific electromagnetic frequencies. And since then, Rife's work has gone underground and is not really accepted now. You know, whether that's a conspiracy or whether it just, you know, didn't fall into the medical paradigm at the time, I don't make those claims. I don't like to get into that debate. But for whatever reason, it is not, you know, used now. The person that I talked to originally when I was very, very sick in Seattle was Doug McLean. He is a mechanical engineer who had Lyme disease. He had heard about Royal Raymond Rife, but he didn't know anything about him. This was back in 1980, before the internet and before all this information was so easily accessible. And he read a book called The Cancer Cure That Works, which I also have sitting in front of me. This book is by a journalist named Barry Lyons, and it chronicles the story of Royal Raymond Rife. And Doug McLean, who is again the Seattle engineer that I was telling you about in 1980, he said, well, I'm going to try that. I'm going to try and see if this works. So he converted his basement into a makeshift microbiology laboratory, and he acquired spirochetes from the CDC. This was back before, you know, the rise of terrorism, when it was a lot easier just to get experimental materials. He actually got them through a friend who worked at a biomedical laboratory. And sure enough, he set up a coil of 12-gauge wire, simple household wire, about a 6-inch diameter coil. And he resonated that coil at 306 hertz, and he was looking through the microscope when he was doing this, and sure enough, he saw these spirochetes get torn apart and killed right there, under the microscope. And although that was convincing, what really, really convinced him was that this is such a funny story. While he was looking through the microscope, he began to have what we talked about earlier, which is that Herxheimer reaction, and was in bed for 3 days. So not only did he see with his own eyes that the bacteria were being destroyed under the microscope, he also experienced the effect of that electromagnetic field, and that was such a strong confirmation to him that this actually held promise that he dedicated the next 7 years of his life to improving upon that machine and designing it.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, because Brian is telling us about, of course, the experiences of one of his friends who actually was an engineer, electrical engineer, who actually had Lyme disease. He created a Rife-like machine of his own, and actually he was firmly convinced that not only this helped to cure his disease, but he's even developed the machines to a higher degree of specificity. Now, before we go on, Brian, I'd like you to get your website out and tell people how they can get your book.
Sure, yeah, my website is limebook.com. That's LYMEBOOK.com. That's limebook.com. And on that website, I do have quite a few free resources as well. There aren't just items for sale there. I have a lot of articles and research that I've done over the years, but you can also find, I've written 3 books on Lyme disease, actually 4 now. I just published one last week. One is the 2008 Lyme Disease Annual Report. It's a shorter book. It's only about 160 pages. It's more of like a magazine. The other one is called The Top 10 Lyme Disease Treatments. That's been the bestseller so far. The third book is what we were talking about, Lyme disease and rife machines. And then the fourth book, just published last week, is really gonna be a really fascinating story. It's the connection between Lyme disease and autism. I worked on that book with Tammy Duncan, who is a mother of an autistic child who tested positive for Lyme disease, and she began doing this research and finding all these other mothers who had kids with Lyme disease and autism, and she made the connection. Her foundation is actually here in California. It's called the LIA Foundation, L-I-A Foundation, which stands for Lyme-Induced Autism. And our book on the Lyme-Autism Connection, which just came out last week, when I started researching the Lyme-Autism Connection with her, I said, no way. There's no way there's a connection. I'm not going to do this project with you, Tammy. I said, I just don't see it. And she started emailing me studies on Lyme disease and autism, particularly by a couple of very very intelligent physicians and researchers, and I started to become convinced of this connection, so much convinced that I wrote a book on it.
I imagine one of those was Dr. Garth Nicholson, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
All right, because I would love to see that book as well, because Dr. Nicholson's a personal friend, a frequent guest on our program, and he's talked about this relationship between Lyme disease and autism, and I think it's vitally important people understand that these all fit into this same category of things. So basically, let's get your website out, let's get your telephone number.
Sure, yeah, the website again is lymebook.com. My phone number directly to the ordering line is 530-541-7200. That's 530-541-7200. And again, on the website, lymebook.com, www.lymebook.com, you can browse all of these books that we've been talking about. You can be one of the first people to see the new Lyme Autism book. It's not even in distribution yet. It's only available on our website, so it's sort of a first look at that book, and that website again, lymebook.com, www.lymebook.com, has quite a bit of information. There are a lot of free articles. There's a discussion forum on the website now that has over 2,400 members. I started that discussion forum in 2003 to connect physicians and patients on this difficult issue. We have a blog there that's updated two or three times a week. I actually also have a video blog. That seems to be the hottest thing these days, where I create different little short videos, 5 to 10 minutes long, on these different topics. Of course, that is free to view. So again, www.lymebook.com is where you can find all that information. If you want to order any of these products, our direct ordering line is area code 530-541-7200.
Now, what about these Rife machines? Are these available in the United States?
Well, they are, and you know, one of the most empowering aspects of Rife technology is that they are built with common electronics parts that can never be banned. A lot of these parts are the same parts that are used very generically in the electronics industry. So the government, you know, will never be able to stop people from producing Rife machines. I'm looking at a Rife machine right now, and the primary components of it are an amplifier, a music amplifier, some 12-gauge wire, a capacitor bank using oil capacitors. So the Rife machines that I talk about in my book, most of them can be built on a shoestring budget for around $200 to $1,000. Now, if somebody wants to purchase one, if they can't afford to, if they don't have the skills to build it themselves, if they don't want to be connecting electrical parts, there are companies where you can buy Rife machines. There are a number of very reputable ones. I choose not to discuss these, on the air, because I want to be very clear that I'm a journalist and I don't have, I don't want to be connected to any of these companies. I just want to be looking at this from an unbiased perspective. But you can purchase these machines if you're so inclined.
All right, fine. I think it's important that people understand that these things are out there. Can you actually, of course, change the frequency on that from the spirochete to perhaps a cancer or something else?
Yeah, and that is the original application of Rife's technology. The book on Dr. Rife is called The Cancer Cure That Worked, and there was an official trial in the 1930s that examined Rife's technology on 16 cancer patients, and all 16 of them were cured, according to this book that chronicles that story. So the original Rife technology was designed for cancer. I think the Rife technology gets a bad name because there are some people selling it, and they say that it will cure anything. There's a document called the CAFL, which stands for Common Annotated Frequency List, actually Consolidated Annotated Frequency List. And this document has frequencies for every possible condition you can think of, you know, colds, flus, sore throat, you know, bronchitis, allergies, headache, depression. Now, do I believe that life technology can work for every one of those things? Probably not. And I think that that's why it gets a bad name, because, you know, people claim that it's a cure-all. It is not a cure-all. It is a physiological intervention that works in some cases when it is applied correctly, and I think it's important that people understand that. You know, one of the reasons that Rife technology works so well for Lyme disease is because the Lyme disease bacteria is a spiral-shaped bacteria, and it's very long and sort of delicate, so it's more susceptible to resonance. Now, as far as cancer goes, there is a Rife conference that takes place every single year. There's about 300 people that attend it. It happens in Seattle, Washington. This year, the Rife conference, I believe, is in October. You can learn more about that conference. The website's very simple. It's just rifeconference.com. It's an excellent conference. It's run by Richard Lloyd, Ph.D., who has a Ph.D. in nutrition, and he's been in charge of this conference for a number of years. And it draws speakers and exhibitors, and even patients and physicians from all over the world. And I highly recommend that anybody interested in Rife technology, you know, if they can't attend the conference, they can at least, you know, visit that website. Now, I was a speaker at the 2006 Rife conference. I actually interviewed Doug McLean there. We were talking about Doug McLean earlier. He was the first Lyme sufferer ever to use Rife technology for Lyme disease. I have a DVD with that interview. It's an excellent DVD. It's one of our most popular products. It's just a few dollars more than it's available on LymeBook.com. And this DVD is important because Doug McLean, ever since his research in 1980, he hasn't really gone public with any of this. You know, I know him pretty well, so I've talked to him about it quite a bit. But this DVD with the interview of Doug McLean is the only interview in existence where he basically describes his experiments in his basement, where he witnessed these spirochetes being destroyed by electromagnetic frequencies.
Well, of course, the government went after Rife. They really wanted to put him out of business. People say, why would anybody do that? Well, you have to understand that people who have a different worldview than you and I do, we would like to treat disease. We'd like to help people. Well, that is the purpose of physicians. But there are other people who have an exactly the opposite attitude, and they seized, of course, Rife's material. They seized it was basically a specific type of microscope, the most powerful microscope probably ever developed. He was a very, very clever man, and, of course, he did everything they could to destroy him. Whatever happened to Royal Rife, do you know?
Well, that's very interesting. He after his information was suppressed, as you just described, he became very depressed and still pursued his research for quite a while, and ended up sort of a lonely, distraught man when he died, I believe, in the 60s or 70s. But, you know, you mentioned the suppression of his research, and, you know, I generally try to be very conservative when I talk about conspiracy theories and whatnot, because I don't want to sound like you know, somebody who jumps onto the bandwagon of every conspiracy theory. However, when you look at the story of Rife, there really is some proof that this may in fact have been a true government cover-up. There was a number of very funny things that happened to Rife, all in a very short period of time. His laboratory burnt to the ground. In an area that was not known for wildfires, there was no explainable cause for this. Penicillin was released very close to the time that Rife's work went underground. I have a photograph in my Lyme Disease and Rife Machines book of Dr. Rife sitting with some of, at that time, the nation's leading physicians and scientists, and he was really in the spotlight. There's a San Diego Evening Tribune article in 1920 that shows Rife's discovery, and he was all over the news. All kinds of important people were tracking him down and interested in him, and then all of a sudden, bang, overnight, it stopped. So, you know, there is really no logical explanation for that other than the fact that somewhere, somehow, some power that be decided that this needed to stop. And in fact, there were a number of physicians who used Rife devices in their offices, and some physicians that I've talked to still have these old devices. You know, they've been passed down from their grandparents or whatnot from that time. And so Why did the information stop all of a sudden? Why did his laboratory burn down? Why did this go underground? Why did it happen all within a couple of years? You know, it really does make you raise your eyebrows.
Well, of course, so you about been at this as long as I have. I've been at this for about 46 years, and I will tell you that there really are forces out there that have an entirely different worldview, or that are totally not concerned or unconcerned with human suffering. And I've run into them, and I've said, "Why are you opposing what I'm trying to do to help people?" And I'll never forget this woman looking me in the eye with the eyes that looked right like they came right out of the very pit of hell, and she said, "You don't understand, Doctor. We have a different worldview." And that's right. And Crystal Rivers is trying to save the lives of women and unborn children. And of course, she had it. She expressed it, I think, so well. Anyway, let's get back, of course, to the treatment of Lyme disease, because I think that this is really fascinating. Now, certainly, it would rife therapy be a first line? Would you suggest that people go through everything else before they get to that? And what about somebody suggested sauna? Actually, of course, taking sauna treatments and really getting heated up there. And would that help people with Lyme disease?
Certainly. The sauna treatment is one of the most important treatments that you can use. There's a number of reasons for that. First of all, Lyme disease bacteria do not like the heat. They get hurt by the heat, so that is obviously one of the beneficial aspects. In fact, many Lyme disease sufferers are incapable of getting fevers. The bacteria, the pathology in the body actually prevents the fever from occurring, so the sauna can create an artificial fever and really be beneficial in that way. Another aspect that we really haven't spent much time talking about yet is the neurotoxins that are produced by Lyme disease bacteria. That is actually one of the main reasons why Lyme bacteria makes people sick. If the bacteria did not produce neurotoxins, you wouldn't really be sick. And these neurotoxins, it's basically byproduct of the bacteria. You know, it's their waste product. And these neurotoxins are fat soluble, and fat soluble toxins, as I've been looking a little bit on your website, and I noticed that you have some information on mercury. Mercury poisoning is another fat-soluble toxin. Fat-soluble toxins are awful because they bind to the body's fat stores, and guess what? The brain is primarily composed of fatty tissue, so the first place that mercury and Lyme disease toxins go is the brain, and that's why you have some of the devastating neurological symptoms. Now, when somebody gets heated up inside of a sauna, those toxins are released from those fat storage sites, and so they're able to come out. Another incredible benefit of the sauna is that people with Lyme disease and other chronic illnesses often have congested livers, and they have liver problems, and the liver is usually the primary detoxification organ in the body. Well, if it's not working right, guess what? You're not detoxing well. So a sauna is incredible because it completely bypasses the liver. These toxins are able to escape directly from the skin without ever needing to go near the liver, so you have this incredible benefit of these people who cannot get any of these toxins out of their body through their liver and through their colon and through their kidneys, and boom, you know, in a 20-minute sauna session after sweating, a large portion of these toxins just can leave right through the skin. So it really is, you know, sauna therapy also goes back to what we were talking about. It's sustainable in that it's affordable. You can purchase a sauna. I have a book that tells you how to make an electric light sauna that you can make in a closet in your home for $100. And so it's affordable. It can be done at home. It's non-toxic. It's beneficial. So that is you bring up a sauna. That's a perfect example of a treatment that is an ideal candidate for Lyme disease treatment. It is exactly what we're looking for. So the sauna is at the very top of the list of ideal supportive treatment.
And, of course, these will all be listed in your book, then. The book you're going to send me on the background.
Yeah, I was just going to send you the top 10 Lyme disease treatments, but now that we've talked, I'll send you all the books that I have. But, yeah, the third chapter in my book is on detoxification therapies for Lyme disease. And the sauna is one of the primary detoxification therapies. My book, The Top 10 Lyme Disease Treatments, is broken down into two sets of five treatments. The first five are what I call the core treatment protocols, and those are sort of the main big guns that we use to fight Lyme disease. This detoxification, antibiotics, which we talked a little bit about, Rife machine therapy, the Marshall Protocol, which we actually haven't talked about very much. Then the second five treatments in my book, The Top 10 Lyme Disease Treatments, those are what I refer to as the supportive supplements. And these five supplements are not intended to be primary, meaning that they're not enough to fight Lyme disease alone, but they are very helpful. One of those treatments is called systemic enzyme supplementation. Many people are familiar with taking digestive enzymes to help with digestion, but what a lot of people don't know is that if you take those same digestive enzymes on an empty stomach, a small portion of those enzymes actually get absorbed into systemic circulation, and those enzymes actually circulate through the body and digest what we call circulating immune complexes, which is just basically debris and garbage in the body. And in this is used in Germany more than aspirin or Advil. The primary product that I recommend, called Webenzum, is a German product. It's manufactured in Germany. It's a very popular treatment over there. And that's, you know, an excellent, excellent supportive treatment. Also, again, affordable, non-toxic, can be done in the privacy of one's own home. With Lyme disease, you're really looking for these treatments that empower patients to be able to take control of these treatments.
Well, of course, these children, certainly I don't think all autism is Lyme disease associated, but certainly some of it is. Are these children helped by antibiotics? Or how do you approach the child who's, with autism and a Lyme disease parent?
Sure, yeah, that's an important question. What you mentioned there is very important that we do, agree with that. Not all autism is caused by Lyme disease. In fact, it might be only about 10 to 20%. But when you're talking about autism, you're talking about, you know, almost a million active cases right now, and so 10 to 20% is quite a few kids. So, yeah, you know, we're not saying that every case of autism is caused by Lyme disease. Now, another convincing aspect of the Lyme-autism connection...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Brian, go right ahead. You were talking about, because another interesting aspect of the Lyme-autism connection. Go ahead.
Sure. One of the other convincing factors that made us really look into the Lyme-autism connection as being a real problem is the fact that these autistic kids, many of the autistic kids, actually do improve on Lyme disease treatment. And so, you know, everybody's scratching their head saying, you know, why are autistic children not responding to behavioral therapies, not responding to common autism treatments? Why are they responding to antibiotics and to Lyme disease treatment? So that's just another piece of the puzzle that we saw that really allowed us to make that connection.
Of course, it's Dr. Scott Nicholson's view that, of course, in addition to the Borrelia spirochete, many of these children have mycoplasma and other of these chronic infections, chronic brucella, chronic diseases, chlamydia. All of these diseases seem to be associated with the Lyme disease. Have you noticed that, or have you gone
with that? That's a perfect segue into another important topic. That's what we call co-infections. And in the Lyme autism book, I refer to that as the infection stew. Because you're right, it is not just Lyme disease. There are mycoplasma and viruses in Candida. And the reason for that is that once the immunity is weakened and once the door is opened for these infections to come in, you don't just get one or two that comes in. You get a lot of them. They're what we call opportunistic infections, which means that when there is an opportunity, they establish themselves. So, yeah, you have a number of different infections that do occur both in Lyme disease and in autism. You're correct in saying that Dr. Garth Nicholson has some great data on that. We cite his research quite a bit in the book. He's one of the primary sources. And so a lot of these treatments, you know, cannot just be aimed at Lyme disease. They have to also recognize these other infections as well. And, you know, they also have to recognize the detoxification and nutrient supplementation, particularly for Lyme disease sufferers, magnesium. So there is a whole range of interventions that need to occur. Some of the more common co-infections with Lyme disease are Babesia, which is a red blood cell parasite, Bartonella, also known as cat scratch fever. There's a great new book on Bartonella by Dr. James Schaller in Florida. It just came out about a month ago. You can also purchase that book on my website at limebook.com. And Dr. Schaller's book presents hundreds of photographs of how to detect Bartonella on the skin. It's actually quite evident on the skin, but he also presents some breakthrough research that hasn't been published before on the neuropsychiatric, neurological effects of Bartonella as well.
Well, we're out of time, Brian. I really appreciate you being with us. Well, I guess. This has been Brian Rosner, and we've really had a great time. In fact, I think we could probably go on for another hour or two, but we've run out of time for this evening. But Brian, I will be calling you to get you onto our other programs. I'm really looking forward to getting your book and your books. And I think I want to get your information out. And I think it's vitally important that we reach as many people as we can and let them understand, really, of course, that this is not imaginary, it's real. And we have probably, what do you think, 1 million people plagued with Lyme disease?
Yeah, it's probably definitely in that area, 200,000 cases a year, many of which aren't being treated.
Okay, well, we're out of time. Good night. God bless. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Brian Rosner, and I hope you enjoyed our program. And of course, we do have a 4-tape set on Lyme disease. We have, of course, the new DVD by Dr. Garth Nicholson. We call it Terrible New Diseases. And of course, it's the talk he gave at our last conference. Really quite well done. In fact, Dr. Nicholson asked for 3 copies of his own talk, of which we sent him the DVD and nicely packaged. So if you'd like the Dr. Garth Nicholson, Terrible New Diseases, if you'd like to get Dr. David Aube's talk on mercury autism and the global population agenda, you have to understand that a lot of this is actually used to promote population control. And then, of course, we have the 4-tape set on Lyme disease. Of course, we have our DVD on, none dare call it, genocide. We have a DVD on planned population control. And then, of course, we have, as we mentioned before, the interviews with Dr. Dunnigan, a practicing pediatrician in Pittsburgh until he retired and, of course, recently died. But he tells about having the opportunity in 1969 to hear the whole story laid out by Dr. Richard Day, who was the formerly medical director of Planned Parenthood, who told you the whole thing of how they're creating new diseases, suppressing treatments for cancer. And we have this transcript of this. Ladies and gentlemen, when you listen to this, you'll say this could not be true. Nothing could be that evil, and yet I would tell you that there really is organized evil in the world. And if you want to get the 4-tape or 4-CD set on the New Order of the Barbarians, and the transcript are available from Radio Liberty, that's, in addition, you need to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or the DVD that goes with that. Or you want to get our talk on The Forbidden Secret. That's The Forbidden Secret. And, of course, we go into the background of the organizations working behind the scenes that really do control what goes on in the world. We have a brand new DVD we're offering. It's called Secret Knowledge. Secret Knowledge. It's available from Radio Liberty. And then, of course, you want to get our material on planned police state, the planned police state, because you want to get the syllabus that goes with that. And the syllabus, of course, actually has some of the writings, some of the publications of the people on the other side. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are people on the other side. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're creating terrible new diseases. And if you doubt that, why, first, you try to get a copy of Zygmunt Bzezinski's book. Zygmunt Bzezinski, former National Security Advisor to President Carter, today the Foreign Policy Advisor to Barack Obama. But of course, back in 1970, Bzezinski wrote a book called Between Two Ages. Try to get a copy on Amazon. It's amazing how expensive they are. And then, of course, we hope that you'll certainly want to get the... if you get the book, why, of course, somewhere between page 55 and 65, and one of the footnotes, he talks about how in the future we're going to be able to create storms and droughts, in other words, weather change, and then how we're going to be able to create chronic new diseases. How we're going to be able to create chronic new diseases. Now, that was written in 1970. Of course, it was the previous year when, of course, Dr. David MacArthur had addressed the House Appropriations Committee, and we have his complete testimony. And he talks about how he wants $10 million to create a new disease for which there's no immune response, which, of course, is AIDS, and then chronic new diseases. Could anybody be that crash? Yes, we actually have the reports from the CIA that were supposed to have been destroyed on the Special Virus Cancer Project when they were creating these new diseases. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Good night and God bless you.